Welcome. I'm Dr. Anu, co-host of the Hormone Super Conference, and today I'm joined by Dr. Neil Polvin. Neil is a physician and also a leading expert in biohacking and human optimization. He has certificates in family medicine, anti-aging medicine, and osteopathic manipulation. Welcome, Neil.
Hello, how you doing? Thanks for having me on.
I'm really well. Thank you so much for being here, Neil. We want to start with, you have a wealth of information from all of the background that you've been studying, but I really wanted to start with your approach to hormone therapy when you see a patient come into your clinic. What are the things that go through your mind?
The main thing is two things. One, we want to make sure that patients understand that things are not cookie cutter. They come in and say, "Oh, my friend is on this and this and this, so I want I want that." Or they so that's the first thing. The second thing is we want to make sure we ask them what their symptoms are and what their goals are. Because again, if women are having no hot flash and just feeling a little brain foggy or bloated, that's one thing. Or if they're totally having no libido and other issues, then we have to target otherwise. So I'm just getting over allergies here in the US. So that's kind of how we approach it. That's the first thing we're looking at. And then also understanding what patients prefer. Some patients have no problem injecting themselves. Some patients don't even want to look at a needle. So there's a lot of different things you want to understand where the patient's coming from and what their goals are, because it's there's so many things available now that you can kind of mix and match really easily for them.
So what I'm hearing is that it's actually a very personalized approach because there can be a whole host of symptoms, right? From the physical to the emotional to the cognitive function. And you are tailoring your treatment quite differently depending on how somebody is presenting.
Definitely. Yeah, it's very personalized. And that's what's great about hormone therapy now is that we can target their specific goals, their specific lab work, their specific genetics, and make a program for them and help them get to their goals really quickly.
So, how do you do that actually? Or what does that look like?
Again, it's the first thing is we get a detailed d diary of, especially in females, in terms of are they having cycles? Are they regular? How many days are they? What symptoms are they having? So that's, the first things. And then we again detail what we have kind of a big five for women and a big five for men. Are men having brain fog or poor workouts or muscle loss or decreased libido? In women, again, hot flashes, poor sleep, bloating, problem with memory. And then we can kind of specifically, again, start with the lab work, their exam, and their lab work and what their symptoms are, and then we develop a plan for them. And then again, we'll start them usually slowly with one or two medications. And then we kind of will build up depending on what's working, what's not working. But usually it's usually hopefully get resolution of the symptoms pretty quickly.
So, from your perspective, testing is really important because our audience is quite mixed and we're coming from different places. And of course, some people are told various things about the need for testing. But from your perspective, what would you say about
Oh,
testing?
testing is mandatory. You can't treat what you don't test, especially with hormones and from all, especially estrogen, testosterone, thyroid hormones, any of them. The treatment is so diverse depending on what the lab levels are. So we don't want to have anybody have too much estrogen, not enough estrogen, same with testosterone. So you need to A, know where people are starting from, and then you need to know where they are 3 to 6 months later to make sure you can tailor that treatment. To just get like just throwing some random darts at a dartboard, it's not good for me. It's definitely not good for the patient.
Right. And the different types of hormone therapy out there, can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, there's so many different types that are out there now, which is again is really great for patients. There are there are creams out there for patients that can be anything from just estrogen to combining testosterone, progesterone, DHEA. So they can apply there. There are oral medications. I don't prescribe either oral estrogen or oral testosterone, but there are people who do. There's just too many side effects of associated with that. But it can be done. There are also some injectables that are out there, especially for men, and some women are doing like injectable testosterone. There's also where we're able to do vaginal creams, vaginal suppository for women who are having specific menopausal symptoms like vaginal dryness or pain with intercourse. And so those are the main ways that we can administer therapy. I mean, there's also pellet therapy. Pellet therapy kind of had a huge popularity, which is kind of waning now. They're just not as controllable as some other methods at this point, but some people, especially who have a very active lifestyle, will just prefer the pellets, but they've kind of waned a little bit in terms of popularity.
And all these hormones you're talking about are bioidentical, yes. Could you tell us a bit about bioidentical? What does that mean? Why is it important?
Sure. Oh, yeah, bioidentical are derived either from different animal or yam. There's different derivations depending on the pharmacy. They are not just basic estrogen pills or patches you're going to get from your regular pharmacy. So they're not going to be covered by insurance. They have less side effects. Certain estrogens, so like I mentioned, especially oral estrogen, can have some liver issues. So that's why I tend to avoid it. And what's great about the bioidentical hormones is that we're able to, down to like the 0.25, quarter of a milligram, tailor a program for patients. It could be 0.25 of estradiol or this of estriol or this of testosterone. And then we can really fine tune it as opposed to just the prescription creams or patches, which are pretty much two or three doses and you can't interplay with it, which is not as great for patients. And we find sometimes because of the way they're designed, they don't absorb as well. So again, I really prefer my patients to use the bioidentical hormones just for improving the levels as quickly as possible, as well as for administration and less side effects usually.
Right. So just to summarize, some of the kind of off the shelf stuff is not going to be identical in structure to our body's own hormones. And also we don't have that same flexibility to really target the dose down to, 0.25 milligrams of estrogen.
Exactly. Yeah. They're not as close as to what we're being able to administer into our bodies. Yes, definitely.
Yeah. And how does that play out for patients? What does that actually translate to? Have you seen people come in on standard hormones and then have to change, or, what's been your experience?
It used to be patients on standard and not getting the response. As we were discussing before the interview, things have changed now in the last year or 18 months or so, where patients are now being much more proactive about their care. And they're coming in and saying, look, I know I don't want to have any menopausal symptoms. I know there's risk as I get older of just being menopausal and not having estrogen or not having progesterone. So it's kind of, again, totally done a 180, which is really good for patients. And I really applaud that. So again, it's really now patients, and most patients want bioidentical. I mean, the cost is the main concern, obviously, where it's not covered by insurance as some of the other prescription patches that aren't bioidentical may be. So that's the one little bit of a red flag for patients. But a lot of patients now are coming in specifically for that. They're worried about all the symptoms. it's either going to be the sleep issue or it's the cut. I mean, I don't say amazingly, but a lot of people are worried about the appearance, the skin. They want their skin. They want to look like they're 30 when they're 80 years old. So that's where everybody's heading now, which is, again, it's a great motivation to have.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're finding then that people are much more clued up, is what you're saying, that people already know a bit about the difference between bioidentical and synthetic hormones, and they also know the importance of treating menopause. Can you tell us a bit about that, the importance of treating menopause or andropause for men?
Sure. So in terms of menopause first, we know women that have early menopause, their lifespan may decrease by like 3% per year that they're early. And they also have women who have early menopause, and we're saying less than the age of 50. Which most people aren't aware of, because a lot of women don't get to 50 with menopause, with having a normal menstrual cycle, that there's an increased risk of diabetes, there's an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease, there's an increased risk of obesity. So our goal, again, the paradigm, at least in the U.S., has been a lot of, hey, you have a female issue, here we'll push on birth control, suppress your hormone. Now we're trying to flip that because we know the risk of that. as more and more studies come out. So in terms of patients who, females who are looking for hormone replacement, it's a combination of treating the symptoms they're having at that moment and then prolonging, work on prolonging their health span, which is how healthy you live during life, and then also the ultimate chronological years that they're going to live. Men are a little bit different. It's kind of tends to be a macho thing a little bit. They want to, or they hear about their buddy doing it. Again, we know though that men testosterone starts decreasing around the age of 30. Some people say about 1-3%. But men also will have specific symptoms. They'll have brain fog. They're going to have erectile dysfunction. They're going to have the inability to build muscles quickly. They'll have decreased energy. They may have problems sleeping as much. So men are, again, the same situation where we know that having low testosterone will affect longevity in the long term in terms of lifespan, but it's also going to affect the risk for neurodegenerative issues like Alzheimer's. It's going to affect, again, risk for obesity, diabetes. So it's a combination of, again, on both sides, changing the short term, helping people feel better, and then optimally, hopefully, if they adopt a healthy lifestyle, live longer as well. So there's, I mean, again, the data is that we know the patient, the hormones are dropping, and we know they have side effects, and for a while we never did anything about it, which I don't understand. And now we're kind of, again, flipping the script 180 degrees.
And it's especially important about men, isn't it? Because the conversation around menopause for women has really picked up. But certainly in the UK, and I think in Europe, andropause is less talked about. What's your view on that? Why is that the case? And where's it going?
It's actually the opposite here in the US, is that until recently, menopause was just assumed, and people it was just kind of, okay, I'm in menopause now, and I'll just have to deal with this the rest of my life. The reasons I know that people just don't talk about it is because some of the symptoms are kind of things men want to keep on the QT. They don't want to talk, oh my God, I don't have the libido. I'm unable to have an erection anymore. My workouts aren't as good. So it's something that people may not want to talk about as much with their doctor. And in addition, I know different countries have really differing opinions on testosterone replacement. Some people think it's not, has no value at all, unless it's somebody's really, really, really severely low. Other countries won't even allow it to happen at all. So I think it's the inability sometimes to get the medications. And also I think it's sometimes the weird talking to your, like, women go to a gynecologist, so they're going to have these conversations on a 6 month or every year basis. Men aren't always going to go to their doctor and talk about it unless a doctor brings it up. Now, at least in the US, there's online things talking about every 5 minutes. I don't know how it is throughout Europe, but I know there's it's become in the last year or two, not everybody knows about it now. Everybody's talking about it almost too much.
Sorry, I might have said that wrong, but I think we're both on the same page. Menopause is well known about, and andropause for men, I think, is not getting the attention it deserves. And you've mentioned some of the reasons why that might be. What would you say to men out there?
I would say to men that talk to your doctor or be proactive about looking at your hormones, seeing where you are. Pay attention to what your workouts are. Pay attention to your libido. Understand that you are losing testosterone yearly, and it's something that you should not be embarrassed to ask for, not something you need to be embarrassed to go on. But on the flip side a little bit, it's not something that's a competition with your best friend that, oh, my testosterone's 750 and mine's 900. So I'm bad. It's, again, men and women are competitive. But it's not something to be embarrassed about. It's something you do want to talk to with your doctor about. Again, even though it could be a sensitive subject.
Right. So we're very much aiming for very physiological levels and no kind of excess competitive edge, or, you know, not that not being the motivation, but the motivation being very much coming from a health prevention aspect.
Exactly. Yes.
And what about younger patients? I mean, you mentioned with testosterone, the men could be as young as 30 plus. What about younger women? What do you find happens with their hormones?
Oh, that could be an hour conversation by itself. As I said, at least what we're seeing in the US is a combination of different things. We have a lot of women who are just, they have a little bit of a painful have numerous issues. And again, they're just placed on birth control, which suppresses their hormones when they're 16, 18, 20 years old. And then they come in a couple years later and they're like, I'm really tired, I'm gaining weight, especially in the abdominal area. And then we do their lab work and they have menopausal hormone levels. And I'm like, well, we have a decision to make. So that's the shame of that. And I think that we need to have younger women need to be more aware of what they're putting in their bodies and understand the effects that has on them long term, which I think the doctors, especially the doctors normally prescribing it, don't really kind of have that full grasp of yet. The other pieces that we're seeing in younger women, unfortunately, there's two kind of different opposite buckets. We have women who have polycystic ovarian syndrome, which is abnormal functioning of the ovaries, where they can get acne or they can get hair on the wrong places, be infertile. And again, it seems to be, they're just trying to, doctors don't know how to treat them. We're starting to look at further treatments for it. Because again, we know that especially it can make women have decreased ability to reproduce. So that's kind of gaining more knowledge here, but it's still something where women are told, oh, I'm sorry, there's not much we can do about it. Or we'll just put you on medicine to suppress the testosterone, which actually makes their hormones worse, and you really haven't done anything. And then the last kind of batch that we're seeing in that younger generation are women who do have issues that we may need to work on their hormones, either fibroids or endometriosis, which is sometimes overproduction of the endometrial tissue, which can be very painful, life-altering, affecting sleep in their life. And that those are the patients that we may need to suppress hormones a little bit and address hormones just to have them have a normal functional life. I mean, that's the unfortunate. We're still waiting. There's still not great treatments except for surgery for some of these things. In some cases, especially with endometriosis, it's not something, it's something that can come back pretty frequently. So we're seeing, again, a lot of different baskets in terms of how females are hormone-related issues. The good news is even that kind of group of patients are being much more proactive with their hormones. If they're primary or their gynecologist is the one to talk about it at that moment, they're seeking out doctors like me who can kind of at least test where they are, see where they are, that coordinate with how they're feeling, and then trying to put the pieces together. Okay, my hormones are good. Maybe it's something else. Or, wow, I have menopausal levels. Maybe we can do something here to get them going. So we're seeing a lot of different factors in terms of females, younger females and their hormones. But again, I think it's good. It's a good thing that we're seeing right now.
So in summary, for younger women with hormonal issues, it's in many cases, suppressing the hormones with the birth control pill is just not cutting it. It's really advantageous for them to sort of take a more functional medicine approach and go deeper.
Exactly. Find the cause, see what's going on. There's a lot of new things out there that can help no matter what the situation is, as opposed to just having a blanket treatment of birth control pills or just suppressing the hormones.
We've talked a bit about the sex hormone problems that you see, which relates to estrogen, progesterone, testosterone. Can you tell us a bit about thyroid issues that you come across?
Another hour conversation there. But yeah, thyroid is one of those interesting ones where everybody's known about that for years. Everybody thinks their thyroid's off, and when they have any symptom from fatigue to brain fog to weight gain. So again, that's something we definitely want to test. Number one. Number two, I would definitely make sure patients are aware, at least in the U.S., and I think it's worldwide, that the levels that are in the labs are not really the levels, optimal levels that we're looking for. So you want to work with a doctor who knows kind of how to optimize your hormones. And the third piece is, A, make sure that your doctor is ordering the right test. Make sure you're getting a total T3 and T4, or free T3 and T4 with a TSH, which is the test that everybody orders, and optimally thyroid antibodies. So that's the first piece. Again, like I said, you can't treat what you can't test. And then in terms of thyroid issues, we're seeing a lot of patients who are definitely underactive, more than I used to. You're gonna have symptoms like weight gain and hair loss and fatigue and problems sleeping. I mean, those are signs that patients are underactive, and a lot of those patients have, unfortunately, have other issues going along with it, that they're insulin resistant, meaning that their insulin's not working as well, or the female hormone issues as well, because thyroid is kind of the big domino that everything else connects to. If your insulin's off, your thyroid may be off. If your progesterone's off, your thyroid may be off. So with thyroid treatment in patients, we try to treat as many other issues first to see if the thyroid will kind of regulate itself on its own. And if it doesn't, then we really deal with thyroid-specific treatment. And again, it's something that we kind of go low and go slow with. Again, there's both traditional thyroid prescriptions, and then there's also compounded thyroid medication. They both work pretty well. I mean, I like the Armour or thyroid that's available here in the US, which is a combination of T3 and T4 as opposed to just being T4, which is not the active hormone. So that's what we see in terms of thyroid hormone issues. It's something that becomes more prevalent. It can be affected by so many things, like I just mentioned. And also, we're seeing a lot more patients, unfortunately, who have been exposed to toxins, either heavy metals like lead or mercury, or they're exposed to BPA or phthalates or some toxin in their daily environment, from anything from their sheets to the cookware they're using. So there's so many things that affect thyroid. I guess it's kind of that big domino that everything can push off, which is make things with thyroid much more complicated, but it's something that we always look at.
Right. So that's a very big piece. And what about nutritional aspects? How does that relate to the thyroid?
It's a combination of things. We know that gut health in general is going to affect the thyroid because gut's a big part of your immune system. So that is going to potentially, again, risk of autoimmune thyroid issues, the things like Hashimoto's. We know there's certain nutrients that you need. You need magnesium, you need calcium to make the thyroid work. So we want to make sure they're getting the appropriate amount of food that are high, leafy vegetables, things like that, to make appropriate. There's a bigger debate about iodine-based foods. That's, you talk to a different doctor, you can get different answers from everybody on that. There's some patients we find that are an issue with gluten that may affect the thyroid as well. So we want to make sure they're getting the nutrients appropriate for the thyroid. And then if they are have some type of food allergy or food sensitivity, that may play a part, but that's not the same for everybody. So nutrition definitely plays a part in how we control thyroid. And then you kind of put that all together in a really big picture.
Fantastic. So in summary, the thyroid is a really big thing, needs to be tested. It's common. And then if it's underactive, we need to look wider. So the gut, nutrition, toxins. Neil, I wanted to ask you a bit. I mean, we've covered the sex hormones, we've covered the thyroid. I guess that leaves one other big area. And I know this is probably going to be another hour that you could easily spend on this. But just briefly, what about the adrenals from your perspective?
The adrenals, that is, at least in the US, become more and more controversial. There's a term out there we call adrenal fatigue that we know isn't totally real. The adrenals can be overworked from stress, toxins, and other damage. So we do pay attention to the adrenals. We're definitely looking at a fasting morning cortisol that will help us evaluate where they are. You also want to do a 4-point urine cortisol where we're able to check the cortisol pattern throughout the day to peak in the morning, relax at night, because it definitely can affect sleep, it can affect energy, it can affect weight gain. So we definitely pay attention to it. I mean, I check it on all my patients. I'll do usually both a morning and a 4-point cortisol in those patients. And also, it's another one of those big, big dominoes in the sense that everything affects it. I mean, the one, like I explained to my patients, it's kind of in a seesaw with a hormone called DHEA that men and women have, which helps with weight and sugar balance and helps your body make testosterone. So there's an issue there that if one is off, the other one is off. Like I said, it's like a seesaw. We also know that, again, progesterone, insulin, other hormones are going to affect cortisol. So it's one of those things where it's not just, okay, take either some ashwagandha or rhodiola or phosphatidylserine to lower it, or ashwagandha or rhodiola to hopefully balance it out, if you don't fix the things that are around it. It's like kind of fixing the result and not the cause. It helps people in the short term because they'll have more energy, they'll sleep better, they may be able to lose weight, their brain fog may go away. So there's definitely some relationship in terms of how your adrenal is working. And we know there's definitely a relationship between the adrenals and the gut and adrenals and your thyroid and adrenals and the pituitary, where a lot of your major hormones are produced, but testosterone and cortisol all based in your pituitary, your thyroid, all of that. So cortisol is definitely one of those things that's very connected, and it's something you definitely want to have addressed by your doctor. The one thing I don't like is there's certain terms out there which aren't as scientifically accurate anymore, but it's something that your doctor should definitely be looking at. And again, getting both, like, kind of when you get a morning cortisol, it's a very small snapshot. Well, if you're getting the 4-point, we're getting it all day or for 2 days, you're getting the really big panoramic view of your gland function. That's actually a lot more helpful.
Right. So the controversy is actually around the semantics, right? The words, yes, or the explanations we're trying to give. But I guess everyone's in agreement that stress is a huge factor in all of our diseases.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. It's semantics. And I think it was kind of a buzzword 2 or 3 years ago. Now people are, definitely a big piece of the puzzle. But again, it's just one of those pieces.
Right. So looking at cortisol and DHEA, looking at the sex hormones, looking at the thyroid, looking at the insulin, this is really the kind of the foundation from your perspective of getting someone back on track.
Yes, looking at all those things that we call, everybody uses the same kind of analogy. The hormones are a symphony. They all have to play together and work well together. It's a team. So if one is off, if one doesn't sound good, the whole orchestra is not sounding good. So we want to, again, I don't know if one of your lecturers put up that big, there's a huge chart that has from pregnenolone. We didn't talk about things like pregnenolone steel, where you're making too much of one hormone. So if one piece is off, that whole giant pathway goes off. And then you have patients who have low testosterone or low estrogen or their cortisol off. So you want to look at all the different pieces of the puzzle and then put it back together again, which is kind of fun, which makes it, nobody's the same. It's not like, okay, here's your, you have a bronchitis, here's your antibiotic and you're done. There's always, everybody's different, what works and what doesn't work. And trying to get down to that root cause is always fun when patients start feeling better.
Mm-hmm. And this stuff is so common. I mean, I think that's the other thing, isn't it? It's just, it's so prevalent and really from quite a wide range of ages. Why do you think more people don't know about it?
Again, I think it's a combination of issues. I think, one, doctors don't talk about it. Doctors are more in treat after rather than a prevent before type thing. I think that's number one. I think most doctors don't know how to deal with it or don't want to have the time or the knowledge base to deal with it appropriately. Like I said, everything's connected. So it's not just, okay, I'm going to fix your thyroid. You have to fix all the other things that go along with it. So they don't have the knowledge base or the time or both to do that. I think some patients, like I mentioned before, just don't want to talk about it. Again, if it's sexual issues when a patient comes in and talks to you about fatigue, I mean, that, again, that could be 1,000 different things. So it's kind of like, okay, where do I put my efforts here? So you need somebody who has a holistic view, has the time to spend with patients. Not least in the US, when you see the doctor for 7.5 minutes, they're not going to be able to do a really deep dive. They're not even talking about, oh, how's your workouts or how is your sexual function? May come up once a year in your physical. So I think it's totally a combination of things. And again, I think also there's used to be some shame in starting on these medicines. I mean, thyroid's pretty mainstream at this point, but if a woman was on hormones like estrogen or progesterone, there was kind of a stigma to it. Men and testosterone 10 years ago was bad. And now it's like, ooh, look at me, I'm on all this testosterone. Look what my number is. So it's kind of, again, the paradigm has kind of flipped a little bit. But again, I think what's great is now becoming a major part of the conversation in people's health, which is great.
What do you think is the future of aging? This is a really big question.
There you go. There's a whole day conversation. I think the future of aging is a couple different things. I think the future of aging is definitely personalized medicine. Like we kind of talked about the whole time here, is that patients are going to test everything. I mean, I know my patients I'm amazed now. I have patients asking me for tests that I never thought they'd want or go through, and they want more and more data, and that's important. They also want to prevent things. That's number one. I think we're leading towards a very futuristic aging system where we're going to be doing things like gene therapy and being, I mean, people are talking about doing 3D printing organs in 10 years and having new skin. I mean, that's like kind of like Terminator type stuff or sci-fi stuff that may actually come to fruition. And I think it's also, again, I think aging is going to be that we're able to, almost everybody will have available to them a program where they can not only live to a higher age, long they're going to be able to live healthier. And that's kind of always been the goal of how we practice is, it's about your health span. It's great that you get to 99 years old, but if you're hospitalized for the last 20, maybe it wasn't done the right way. Maybe it's not the best thing for you. So I think there's a lot of pieces to it. I think things that we had kind of just postulated about are coming to fruition, which is great. And again, it takes the patient to want to do these things. I mean, nobody talked about VO2 max. Nobody talked about zone exercise 3 or 4 years ago, except for like exercise scientists. And now it's everybody's on their wearable looking, okay, where am I doing now? And again, I think people like Peter Thiel and Andrew Huberman are kind of leading the charge there. And it's great that they're able to get the word out so people are interested again and they're educating their doctors, which is good and also kind of has, it's kind of a shame at the same time.
So the first step is that people are, you know, going for the tests, and that, I suppose, is a fundamental part of the medicine becoming personalized. How important are hormones in this piece?
Hormones are the most important piece, as I tell everybody, is lifestyle changes. Obviously, sleep, exercise, diet, that's the core of everything we've been talking about. I can put anybody on any hormone. If they're sleeping 2 hours a night or never go to the gym, doesn't matter. But then after that, hormones are very important. Hormones are literally the lifeblood of our, how we function. I mean, again, they make your brain work. They make your brain work. They're going to help the heart work better. They're going to give you energy. They're going to lower your blood pressure. So they're going to help you be healthier and live longer. So it's something that you need to adopt the core things and then also do the lab work and the data to optimize them as best you can. And again, it's become much easier, at least in the U.S. You can get at-home testing for a lot of these things. Don't have to leave the comfort of your home or your office and get and done. You can do an online telemedicine call. And you have no excuse now to not optimize your health and your hormones.
Right, because I think it's taken us a while to get our heads around what aging actually is. I mean, there are some aspects, aren't there? There's kind of this frailty. There's loss of muscle mass or sarcopenia. But yeah, could you summarize for everyone out there, you know, what is aging and why these basic things help?
Okay, let me try to do this. So aging is a lot of things. Aging is a combination of probably three things. You mentioned two of them. Aging is maximizing your lifestyle. Aging is maximizing your cellular health and your hormonal health. I mean, we didn't talk about things like autophagy and zombie cells or senescence. We know all these different things affect aging. We talked about stress. We didn't talk about specifically about oxidative stress, but all those different chemical processes, you have to think of your body like a giant factory. And if part of that production line is not working, that affects everything else. You want to not only make sure everything's working appropriately from a cellular level up, but you also want to make sure that you repair and replenish things by fasting or taking supplements or exercising or going in a cold plunge for 3 minutes. All those different things replenish it. So aging is down to that cellular level. And then you mentioned things that we can see and measure. We can look at your abdominal fat. We can look at your grip strength. We're going to look, now the bigger buzzwords are sarcopenia, which is the muscle loss that we start having in men and women after the age of 30. And we're adopting treatments, again, two or three that we mentioned throughout the course of the talk here, female hormones, male hormones, thyroid. We want to optimize growth hormone, other things out there. And then the other part is going to be, and then the other part of it is just, again, like I said, the things that we can see and optimizing your brain and your gut. If your brain's not working, then you're in trouble to begin with. And we're luckily walking down the pathway now where we can hopefully prevent brain aging as opposed to treat it, like, unfortunately, when somebody has a problem. So that's going to be the future, like I said, in terms of everything from supplements to hyperbaric chambers to IVs to this, I mean, there's so many cool new things that are coming out that can treat everything from your hormones to hopefully limit the aging in your brain. So aging is a fun future ahead for us.
Wow. What is the, if there is one, what is the one take-home message that you wish people would implement today?
The take-home message would be, well, actually, I'll split to two and one there. Number one is, like I've talked about the whole time, make sure you're working with somebody who can test and develop a plan for you. And also, your goal is to be proactive. Everybody has to be proactive about their own health. Make sure you're living a healthy lifestyle. And then find the people who can help you achieve what you want to do health-wise. And if that one doctor you're working with or whoever that is not working and you feel you're not at your best, find somebody else. You have a world out there now via the internet to find a doctor. Social media, and maybe not so much. You're not going to always find your doc on Instagram or TikTok, but that's the main goal that people need to understand, that they can address almost anything now.
Fantastic. Neil, where can people find out more about you and your work?
Sure. The best two ways are my website, drpaulvin.com, which is doctor spelled out, D-O-C-T-O-R. And then I have on that, there's a blog that I put up a lot. And then Instagram. For some reason, Instagram is where I put a lot of other information up as well. So those are the best two places to check me out.
And anything you're working on at the moment? Any projects coming up?
Yeah, right now we're working on a larger health optimization program where we kind of will give you everything, either in person or throughout the right now the U.S. and some people internationally. And then we're trying to get a course together so people can at least learn some tidbits that they want to learn about. But that's hopefully be by the end of 24. So that's a little bit further down the line.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for today.
Oh, it was great. Thanks for having me on. It was fun.
Thanks a lot.